Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is a podcast about all things early childhood teaching. Launched in 2020, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs began as a resource for teachers beginning the 2020-21 school year in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic and all of the uncertainty that brought for early childhood classrooms. I'm Dr. Christine Lippard, and each episode I interview researchers, classroom teachers, and other practitioners on a specific early childhood education topic. Intended to provide research background, practical ideas, and cheering on from a distance, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is the long-distance mentoring your teacher prep faculty wish they could provide. This week, I have a special guest joining me from the podcast Science of Parenting to talk about temperament and what teachers should keep in mind about temperament. Lori, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your podcast as well.
Thanks, Christine. I'm excited to be here. We've been talking about this for quite some time, so thank you.
Excited to have you.
So my name is Lori Cordles, and I am a part of the Science of Parenting, and I am a parent of three in three different life stages. I have one that's launched, one is in college, and one is in high school, and I am a parenting educator. And as part of the Science of Parenting, our goal is to offer parents the opportunity to hear about research and then apply it to their own reality. We really want parents to understand that there are a lot of different things research says, but we need to sift and sort it to help it fit into our very own family and our very own real life situation. Mm-hmm. So that's really what our goal is at the Science of Parenting.
And I think that's such a great perspective to come from, because in a lot of ways, this podcast has been about taking what we know from research and best practices for teaching, you know, prior to March of 2020, and trying to figure out how does that apply in our current context. And so, so today I want to ask you some about temperament in general and just what is helpful for teachers to know every day, and then wrap up with some questions or thoughts about, as we're navigating COVID-19 and especially a lot of the back and forth and transitions, you know, are there things about temperament to help that are helpful to keep in mind there? So, Lori, can you go ahead and give us an overview of what temperament is?
Absolutely. I do have to tell you that one of my very favorite things in the whole world is teaching early childhood educators about temperament. I've been teaching early childhood professionals for over 20 years, and they're kind of like my kids. You know how child care and teachers get kind of possessive about their children in their classroom? Like, early childhood professionals are kind of like my children, and I get possessive about them. So yes, I
feel very protective right now.
Yes. I am very excited to be sharing temperament with them. So, okay, you might be wondering, what is this word temperament and what does it even mean? So we'll start with a definition. According to Mary Rothbard and colleagues, temperament is defined as this physiological basis for individual differences in terms of their reactivity, their self-regulation, including even motivation or affect, activity, and attention characteristics. So in other words, right, temperament is this predisposition to how we react. It's inborn, it's genetic, it's with us from the very beginning. So think about infants in the nursery at the hospital. No one told them to cry louder than the child next to them. They just do. No one told them to move their arms and legs more vigorously than the child next to them. They just do. It's part of who they are. So it's that thing that we talk about when someone says, oh, she's always reacted that way, even as a baby. Our behavior goes way back to the beginning.
And I think both being parents who have multiple children, like you see it, they start out different, which sets them on a path of having different experiences and so on and so on. And maybe that actually gets into the next thing that I was going to ask you is, so how is temperament different from personality?
Absolutely. This was something that I really had to figure out for myself, because I had done many different types of personality things, you know, as a student, furthering my education. And so when I came upon temperament, I just thought, oh, well, this is just like personality. Mm-hmm. But it's actually not. Actually, temperament is that foundation, because remember we said it's been there from the beginning. So it's the foundation that we essentially build everything else on top of. So personality then becomes these patterns that emerge. So as people react to our temperament, we form our personality around their reactions. Our age or our development, the home we grow up in, the community we grow up in, our education, those things begin to layer on top of temperament. So we start with temperament, and then our environment, our family, growth and development, life experiences, they add those layers on top, and that forms our personality. So we're all different individuals when we're born. Temperament's the same in terms of we all get some when we're born, but everyone is individual, and it honestly remains individual to us. It's responsible for our behaviors, how others, our caregivers, our parents respond. That shapes us. Do they appreciate our temperament? Do they try to understand us? Or, you know, do they want us to behave differently and try to change our temperament? And those are the kind of things that we talk about when we talk about temperament.
Mm-hmm. Before we sort of pull apart the nuts and bolts of temperament, and like you said, the nine traits, why should teachers care about or consider temperament?
So one of my favorite things to say is that temperament gives us a window into why children behave the way they do. So if we look at our windows, especially in the winter here in Iowa particularly, they get a little dirty, and you know, there might be dirt on them. And so what we do in the spring is we take a clean washcloth with sudsy water and Windex or whatever, and we wipe the window clean. And we can see outside, and suddenly there are things that we maybe see that we hadn't seen before. And that's what temperament does, is when we learn about why children behave the way that they do, we begin to see what's behind their behaviors instead of just seeing the behavior itself. What's making them scream loudly? What's making them shy away from a particular thing? So it's like a window into why children behave the way they do.
That makes a lot of sense. And I was just working on a training for the Iowa AEYC talking about, you know, behavior serves a purpose. We often say behavior is communication, but sometimes it serves a purpose to achieve a goal. And I think temperament helps you think about, well, why that purpose? Why does one child go hide under the table during a family get together when lots of people arrive, while the other child runs towards them to give hugs, you know, and thinking about what might be underlying some of that.
Exactly.
So Lori, you mentioned that there are nine traits that we can think about with temperament. So can you tell us a little bit about that? And even for teachers who maybe in their teacher prep heard about easy, difficult, and slow to warm temperaments, that's not nine. So it sounds like you have a more nuanced approach. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, absolutely. So like I said, when you mentioned rhythmicity, I said this is one of the nine traits. And essentially what we're talking about is nine specific temperament traits from the theorist Alexander Thomas and Stella Chess, who looked at a longitudinal study in terms of these nine traits. And those nine traits actually flow into what you talked about, which was slow to warm, difficult, and easy. So let's break down those nine traits. We all get every single one of these. So I'm just going to blaze through these real quickly, and you think about your own temperament. And I also want you to think about maybe a child that you maybe knock heads against. All right. So as we talk about this, I want you to think about a continuum. On the left-hand side of this continuum is a little bit of that trait. And on the right-hand side is a lot of that trait. So for example, the first trait is activity level. Did you get a little bit of activity level for temperament or a lot? Now, activity level is that energy, that internal energy that we all have. I happen to fall on the highly active end of that continuum. So my natural energy is fairly high. I like to move. I like to get out. I like to be active. I have a daughter who is much less active than me. She's very content to sit and watch and observe. So that's how we're going to go through the next 8 traits. Are you thinking about yours? Okay, so thinking about activity level from the left side, lower end of activity, right side, higher end. All right. Activity level, that's the first trait. Second trait, approaching versus withdrawing. When we come upon something new, a new situation, a new person that we have to be introduced to, a new classroom, a substitute teacher, do we approach that newness or do we withdraw? So withdrawing would be over on the left-hand side, that less approaching temperament trait. On the right-hand side, then you have the more approaching temperament trait. Think about yourself and that child that you maybe butt heads with. Do you have similar approachability or different approachability? Is one of you withdrawing and one of you approaching? We then look at adaptability. So adaptability then is that ability to make a change. So you thought you were going to have the red glass at snack time, and now you have the blue glass.
And living with a toddler, let me just tell you, sometimes the color of the glass you got is very important.
Isn't it? Yes. And adaptability, then, that trait says, are you less adaptable when you don't get the color you thought you were going to get? Or are you more adaptable? How quickly can that adaptation happen? So we have activity level, approaching, withdrawing, and the third one, adaptability. The fourth one then that we look at is intensity level. And that's the amount of oomph that you do things with. You hear, see, and feel a highly intense temperament. You may have someone in your household that you know of with a highly intense temperament. In your classroom, these are the children that you see, hear, and probably feel. Now, a child with a less intense temperament is not going to express things as loudly, as vehemently. They're going to have a little bit more calm, cool, and collected in terms of their temperament. I always like to say in my classroom of 3-year-olds when I taught, I have a low intensity level and my co-teacher had a higher intensity level. So it was my job to take care of the really big discipline outbursts because I had a lower intensity.
And I'm thinking about, as people are trying to picture how these come together, and it's easy to go to those children that you do find maybe challenging. And so maybe they're not very adaptable and they're intense. But I did have a little girl, and when I taught preschool, who was very adaptable and very approachable, but very intense. And so she would stand next to me in the mornings as the other children arrived. And yeah, well, she walked in the door yelling, "Good morning, I'm here." And then as everybody came in, and you know, I would do my little teacher squat to be down on their level and say, "Good morning, I'm so glad you're here. It's nice to see you." She would say, "Good morning, we're so happy you're here." So she's very intense.
Yes.
But very, very positive, you know, very adaptable and very, very approaching. So thinking about how these come together is really interesting.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the thing with intensity is it is hot and cold. It can be highly, happily intense, or it can be highly, very unhappy intense.
Right.
Then we look at sensitivity. And sensitivity is, yes, if you think about the 5 senses, are you highly sensitive to sights, sounds, smells, touch? But there's also that level of emotional sensitivity. These children, they see, feel, and hear every subtle type of movement. They catch the subtleness of everything. The child who is less sensitive, boy, I hope you don't think that teacher look is going to make them change their mind, because they aren't even catching that subtleness. And it's not because they're trying to intentionally disobey. Their temperament is just not that sensitive to subtle. They're not going to notice a wet diaper. as much as a highly sensitive child is. We do talk about the sensitivity being kind of one of those secret keys to guidance and discipline, because the less sensitive children aren't going to give you some cues to when they're upset until it's too late. The highly sensitive children, they're going to give you cues and you might be thinking, what is the big deal? Mm-hmm. Sensitivity is one of those hidden guidance and discipline traits that I love talking about. All right, so then we come to distractibility. And you don't really need a definition for distractibility. It is what it is, right? Either you're highly distractible as a child or an adult, or you're less distractible. Now, the thing about distractibility is that there is this layer of the next trait, which is persistence, that bumps into it. So distractibility says, do you notice it? And persistence then says, well, if you notice it, how much are you going to stick with it? So a highly persistent temperament is going to stick with it and stick with it and stick with it, right? A less persistent temperament is going to be more readily accepting of letting something go. So, you know, cleanup time. This is where distractibility and persistence rear their ugly heads sometimes, right? I don't want to be done yet. I want to finish this block tower. I want to finish this game. Or distractibility, the teacher has sung the cleanup song 50 times, right? And the children are so distractible. So those two traits in particular kind of go hand in hand in classrooms. And they're often the source of, but I've told them 65 times.
Mm-hmm. The you last super helpful, and we can loop back to this in a minute, but just as even as you're talking, it's so easy to start to pair some of the strategies we use with children or thinking about those highly persistent kids. Like just saying, I gave you a 2-minute warning doesn't matter. You might really want to be looking at once the last red block is on, or once that. So I'm already starting to see, but I'll let you finish through.
Yes, you are so correct. And remember I said it's like a window, but it's also almost a permission for you to stop beating your head against the wall as an educator. Okay, wait, why isn't this working? Well, you know what? It's not working because it's their temperament. It's not you.
And I think it gives you some permission around the idea that we talk about a lot, that same and fair or same and equitable are different, often look very different. So
very different. So let's take these last two. The seventh one is regularity or rhythmicity, like you referred to it. And the thing that I usually say is, so this particular trait is something that most adults really want control of when it comes to children, because they want to control when and how much they eat, when and how much they sleep, and when and how much they use the bathroom. And that's regularity and rhythmicity in a nutshell. And that the thing about rhythmicity and regularity is we have no control over their temperament. Their temperament came from the adults that birthed them, that gave them their genetics, and we now have to help shape it. And sometimes I like to say, I'm going to write a book, because what we know about research and temperament is that 20% of us have a very regular temperament, which means we probably eat, sleep, and use the bathroom about the same amount every single day. 20% of us are on the complete opposite end, where it doesn't matter what time of day it is, suddenly I'm hungry. I can stay up all night long and be ready to roll the next day because it doesn't matter, you know, how much sleep I have. Or the bathroom. Oh, I did just use the bathroom before I left, Mom, but now I have to go again. All right. So 20% of us are very irregular. 20% of us are very regular. And then there's that 60% in the middle. Mm-hmm. Okay. So back to my book, right? I'm going to write a book about very, very, very strict scheduling, which is not appropriate in early childhood, right? We know that. So 20% of the people, due to their temperament, are probably going to be able to follow a strict schedule. That's because of the temperament, not the schedule. And so those people think I'm a genius. They're going to market all over. They're going to tell their best friends, well, this worked for me. This works for these people. And if it doesn't work for you, there's something wrong with you. Now, there's that 60% in the middle, remember? So about 4 out of 7 days of the week, some type of schedule might work for them. So they're going to think that my book is genius, and the times it doesn't work, it must be them. So if you look at that ratio, right? My book might work, but honestly, it's the child that's working. It's not my book. It's temperament.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love talking to people about this trait when it comes to classrooms and home child care centers that are trying to create this perfect schedule, because there's no such thing when it comes to temperaments at all. And no matter what Aunt Helen says, it's not going to work for the child that is irregular. It just isn't.
Right. And I like that picture of the continuum. I like that you keep going there too, because I think about even in my own house, and you are familiar with this too, right? Like, this is one of the dangers of doing this for your career, is that sometimes you know either too much or just enough to be dangerous. So I sometimes feel very concerned about the variability in our bedtime and wake up routines. But the reality in my house is, on Mondays, people are less tired. So they wake up earlier and they go to bed later. And on Thursdays, we have to wake up both kids and everybody is ready for bedtime, you know, 20 or so minutes before Monday. And so thinking about, you know, my kids, and maybe it's because I put them on it because I'm extremely rhythmic. My husband is extremely not. So maybe this is the in-between we found, but recognizing they're those in-between people. Like, they are not going to fall asleep at 7:16 every night, but they have a pretty predictable range. So I think that's really helpful to think about. And then I think the other thing that you've really just pointed out is, we're going to come back to this, of if you're always planning for a certain type of child, or if you're always planning for what works for you, then you are setting up a percentage of children to be unable to be successful.
Absolutely.
I keep interrupting you. And so I will mention that we will make sure we provide on our Instagram account the list of the temperament traits, but then also we'll connect to your podcast so that if teachers want to go back and hear more about a particular one, then they can do that as well.
Yeah, no.
One or two more to go, so I'll let you finish up.
I just have one, and I appreciate that you're jumping in and making it applicable to childcare classrooms, because that's really our goal, is to be able to say, yes, temperament absolutely does apply to classrooms as well. The last room is short and easy. It's mood. I think of mood as, when we look at the continuum, one end is silly and the other is serious. Temperament researchers talk about negative and positive. The silly mood is more positive. And the little girl that you were talking about that bounds into the classroom and, you know, says, good morning, I would bet that she has a very high positive mood, you know. And then there's the other child that's just a little bit more whiny, and that's the other end of the continuum. So those 9 traits, we get them all. We get a piece of them all, whether it's a lot or a little. And then we toss them into these 3 patterns that you talked about, which was kind of that easygoing, flexible, or that, you know, more difficult or feisty. Mary Sheedy Kersinka talks about it as the spirited child, or that slow to warm or shy child. So when we have those patterns, what we can do is talk about some of the more extreme temperament traits that fall into those patterns.
So just running back through those, then, we're talking about activity, adaptability, approach or withdraw, persistence, frustration, intensity, distractibility, perceptiveness, mood, sensitivity, and then regularity. And we're saying that everybody varies on all of those. So then when you have a classroom of 8, 10, 20 children, you have a lot of different temperaments going on. And so, Lori, how does a teacher apply this in a classroom full of different children?
Well, the idea is that you can begin to predict how children are going to behave. So if you learn about temperament, we actually have research that says learning about temperament just increases the relationship in a positive way between children and adults. So just learning. Okay, guess what? Right now on this podcast, you just learned about temperament. So you have now given yourself the ability to increase the positive relationship between the adult and the child. So obviously one strategy is to learn about temperament. Mm-hmm. The other strategy is really to look at what is it that your temperament might be doing that impacts the children. So you said, Dr. Lippert, that you are very rhythmic, very regular. And so in your early childhood classroom, maybe there were times that you had things set up in a way that was very rigid, very scheduled, not movable, you know, like not spontaneous, but you had a classroom with a majority of children that actually needed you to be more spontaneous. So as the adult in that classroom, it sort of becomes our responsibility to be the person that says, oh, you know what? I can't change their temperament, but I can begin to make adaptations and accommodations for myself and them. The other thing I think that is a really key point in almost all of the traits that come on those extreme ends and the patterns themselves is this idea that we can teach most ages of children to stop, take a breath, and use a lower voice. We call it stop, breathe, talk in our Science of Parenting world podcast. We talk about that a lot with adults, but we also talk about how we can teach children to take a breath, stop what they're doing, and allow their body time to re-regulate. Mm-hmm. And many of the temperament traits that fall on the extremes, that stop, breathe, talk moment helps.
As you were saying, you know, recognizing your own and how that impacts your classroom. I can remember teaching, the lab school I was teaching at the time had morning preschool and afternoon preschool. And those are by nature of parent selection, just different groups of kids, right? Your afternoon kids no longer need an afternoon nap. And so there tend to be your more active kids, you know, just things like that. And so my morning class, they liked our routine. They liked that we walked through the picture schedule every day, and even where they would play and how they would move around the room was somewhat predictable, you know, somewhat over time. The afternoon class was different. And there were days where they were really into the story and we could read three stories in a row. And there were other days where they just needed to get outside, or they came up with this great idea one day of we're going to have a parade. And so I had to learn that, you know, what are the anchors for our day that matter? Not for me to just have control, but, you know, there were some things that I needed some marking points through our routine that helped us and helped kids that were more rhythmic. But then other than that, I needed to really let some variability in. And so that's a great example. The other thing I thought about, as you said, you start to anticipate behavior, is you have your children that you know that you can flash the lights and say 5-minute warning and they're good. They get it. And then you have your kiddos that you know that you needed to let know before that. Mm-hmm. And then you need to walk immediately over to them and say, did you hear how many minutes? And hear them say 5 minutes back. Mm-hmm. And then with a minute to go, you need to walk over and hand them something to carry to the next activity, because you start to anticipate that for that child, this transition is going to be really hard. And so absolutely, I think that's another helpful way, is it puts you in a strengths-based place instead of saying, why can't that kid transition like everybody else does? This isn't that big a deal. Which anytime as an adult, you're saying this isn't that big a deal. You're not seeing it through the child's eyes, but those are stories for another day. But it does help you to anticipate, and those types of differentiations where you can say, this is what I know about you, and I can build on that as a strength to help accomplish our goals, as opposed to you need to fit my mold, I think is really helpful. So that idea of you can start to anticipate because these are predictable things about children is really helpful.
Yes. And think about the amount of time that you as an instructor, teacher, educator spend with a meltdown, right? And so those five things that you quickly said, you know, I need to touch base with them before I hit the lights. I need to hit the lights. I need to touch base with them afterwards. I need, you know, those five things took maybe 5 seconds versus the 25 minute meltdown. So It's where do I want to play this game? I'm cool with 5 seconds and 5 reminders as opposed to 25 minutes of meltdown that stopped the entire classroom.
Yes. And I think that fits well with the idea of goodness of fit. And so I've heard and started to teach more the idea of goodness of fit for classrooms, at least, as not trying to change children, change who they are, but trying to help them meet contextual expectations in a positive way. And I also think there was a time as a novice teacher where I thought goodness of fit meant I needed to meet everybody's needs all the time. So the classroom needed to be exactly what they all needed, which you and I have talked about isn't possible since we all vary. So that idea then of if you can anticipate them, and maybe we stick with transition. I mean, maybe that's an easy one because you think about highly active kids who don't like the next activity you're going to because it's sitting still, or sensitive kids or kids who don't adapt well, any of those. So on any of those traits, once you can start to anticipate what they're going to need, that then you can think about what are the ways that you can help them with their temperament meet these contextual expectations in a positive way. So can I throw a couple at you that I think as a teacher I struggled with?
Yes, absolutely.
I think for children, especially with the younger years, the early childhood years, where we're not to the point yet where we're saying, read this chapter in the book and let's talk about it, but we're offering new materials or we're doing those sorts of things. Any tips you would have towards children who maybe are more likely to withdraw from new experiences as opposed to approach them with curiosity?
Yes. So one of my favorite things to do when I was teaching preschoolers was to draw that withdrawing child closer to the group or into things. And one of the things I did a lot of was making myself the middleman, literally physically. And it didn't even have to be with another person. It could be with a new game, toy, or object. And I would literally put myself in between the child and the object, and we would talk about it. And that seems kind of funny because the object can't move. The object can't, you know, harm the child. But my spacing in between the child and that the child was unsure of provided a sense of safety and security.
Right. And building on that relationship you already have to bridge to that experience.
Exactly. And then putting that into perspective when it came to people. So I think that's one really important piece, is recognizing the child who is more withdrawing and unsure, and how can you provide that sense of foundation and strength for them?
Awesome. What about children who are highly distractible? So especially thinking about that first through third grade range, maybe they are doing more independent work or more time at the desk with the teacher presenting information, and you've got that kiddo that hears the air conditioning kicked on and then notices the cricket in the corner and then sees the principal walk by and has no idea what you were talking about.
Yes, absolutely. I can absolutely relate to this kid. And one thing, as the adults in the classroom, it's really important for us to think about how can we use a variety of reminders, a variety of nonverbal cues to the child who's distractible. So one thing we had suggested in one classroom was that the teacher had a yarn necklace with a big circle, you know, colored paper circle, maybe it was a yellow circle, and she would make sure she got within line of sight of the child who was distracted and just touch the necklace or the visual. And she didn't even have to say anything. It was just a visual, nonverbal cue to the child. Another time we had a child have kind of a private secret cue between them and the child, where, you know, she might walk by the child's desk and rub the top of the desk, and no one else knew what that cue meant, but the child and the teacher knew that that meant, whoa, I got to get back on task. And obviously in early childhood, we talk a lot about getting into their visual space. So getting down to their level. I think the key thing there is that you may have to have a whole pocket full of different reminders. It's not just one that's going to work the same time every day, every way, for every reminder. And when you recognize that you have distractible children in your classroom, again, their temperament is what's creating the behavior. They're not intending intentionally trying to disobey and ignore, you know, whatever is happening. We just have to help them learn tips, tricks, and techniques to deal with the temperament that they got.
I think about thinking about younger, so I asked you about the first through third grade, but something that I started doing in preschool with my really distractible children, and now I'm doing at home. Sometimes I think we have to remember that eye contact and listening don't actually equate. Yes. As much as culturally that's an expectation that some of us have learned, it is culturally laden, and not everybody, you know, eye contact is not always the indicator. And so a lot of times you'll hear teachers say, look at me, your eyes on me, is an indication that you're not being distracted. But that can actually even be distracting for some kids.
Absolutely.
And so I started in preschool saying, put your hand on my hand so I know your ears can hear my words. And I don't hold their hand. It's not a power thing. I'm not physically restraining them. I lay my hands out, palms up, you know, hands open, and say, put your hands on my hands. And I don't know why it works, because I had children that would not do anything else I asked them to do. They would do that one, you know, and that for some of them, I think even that physical grounding is like, okay, now I'm cued in to,
yes,
to what you're saying.
Offering them that chance to re-regulate, to come back from that distraction, and you helped them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one more, the one I am struggling with at home with my toddler is sensitivity. She is so highly sensitive. And I would imagine that it is a challenge for her childcare provider. She feels passionately about everything. So everything is very important. She's really sensitive to being told no, if her friends bump into her. She's currently distraught when she has to take off a favorite shirt or jammies to go through the washer. I mean, like sobbing, like she's very sensitive to these things and has a hard time calming down. So when you're in a classroom and you've got these kiddos or a family home childcare, and you've got these kiddos that are very sensitive, any tips for teachers there?
Well, so think about the good thing about their sensitivity is that it's likely that there is something that they can physically touch or hang on to that can help soothe them, because their sensitivity is just so great that that idea that I can touch this and feel this and smell it and taste it. So you use that to your advantage, right? So
Fluffy Lovey goes everywhere.
Yes, exactly. And so you can also talk about that when you're so sad, we can go get the Fluffy Lovey. When your friend bumps into you, you can take a deep breath and tell your Fluffy Lovey about it. And I think that that for several traits, there are going to be traits that as the adult, we really understand and we get. And there are going to be other traits where we just feel exhausted and exasperated about. And, you know, some of that has to do with our own knowledge as the adult to how hard it was to have that trait ourselves. And so as a highly sensitive person, it's hard for me to see my children also be highly sensitive, because I know how bad it made me feel, how bad every episode of Little House on the Prairie made me cry, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't like it when I see my children be so very sensitive, even though I gave it to them.
And I think in those, that example, even, you know, and I think what we remind ourselves in those situations is, but those really sensitive kids are also the ones that usually start giving other kids their loveys the first, you know, first,
yes,
or recognize that someone else is upset, or,
yes,
you know, that each of these, there are strengths to.
Okay. There absolutely are.
Well, I could keep asking you those for my own purpose, but I think you've given some really great patterns for teachers to sort of think through, you know, if I, as the teacher, am perceiving a behavior as challenge, is there a temperament aspect to it? And the answer is probably always yes. And then if so, how can I understand the needs and what's going on? And are there ways to meet them or to accomplish our goal working, you know, with the strengths of that child's temperament? So we've talked about teachers working with children's temperament a lot, But what could be really helpful for teachers to know about their own temperament?
So as we talked about each of the traits and I asked you to think about the continuum, one thing to recognize is that it's not where the trait falls for both of you. It's where the trait falls for each of you individually, if I can make that distinction. So because you are a highly active adult, the headbutting doesn't necessarily come in when you have a highly active child. It actually probably comes in because you're different. Now, if you look at intensity level, if you're both highly intense, that could be where the issue is. So we absolutely have to look at that combination of what's the adult's temperament and what's the child's temperament and where is that goodness of fit coming in? And you alluded to that. And that's really what Thomas and Chess in their research wanted parents, adults, caregivers, teachers to begin to understand is we may come at this from the idea that how can we help this child? Let's learn about temperament so we can help the child. And we actually might need to reframe it and think, okay, how can I help myself understand my temperament so that I can appreciate and accommodate and help this child appreciate and accommodate their temperament? Oftentimes when I would do classroom observations, teachers at the end would say to me, oh, I see what you did here. I thought you were going to help me fix the child. And actually what you did was, and I think that's a real big key. And as educators, we recognize we are always learning as educators. We are always looking for ways to help our classroom meet the needs of the children, to expand their learning, to grow with them. And when we do that, wow, we grow and expand and learn as well.
I think that's a helpful place too, to start, you know, in reflecting and sometimes recalibrating. And so, you know, a big part of what I do at Iowa State is teacher preparation. And I'm always telling teachers, I'm not asking you to be somebody you aren't, but I am asking you to work within some professional expectations. And so I'm even thinking about withdrawn approach, and I'm thinking about it because it's probably the one I grew in the most as a teacher, where my natural tendency is to say no. Like, mm-hmm. withdraw, no, we're not trying something new is my natural tendency. But I think if you asked people that worked with me or the parents of the kids that were in my preschool class kind of at the end of my classroom teaching period, they wouldn't know that, because I had to recalibrate and say, my natural tendency is to say no 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. That probably means I need to be looking for 30 or 40% of the time to say yes. So if children have this idea, or they, you know, want to stay out 10 minutes longer, or they want to whatever, then I need to stop and say, especially with preschoolers, you can say, tell me what you're thinking. You can't necessarily say that with toddlers, but try to understand, like, what is your reasoning? So that the answer isn't always no. And so I can think about with all of these, you know, we often have pre-service teachers who either their activity level is really high or really low. And we have to say, you can be who you are. You don't have to be the over the top, singing all the time, bubbly teacher, but you do have to calibrate to what it's going to take, you know, to be in a toddler room and to move around, or you do have to calibrate to show that enthusiasm because it engages preschoolers. So
absolutely.
I think sometimes it's helpful to recognize your own temperament, validate that, totally valid to be who you are, and then to say, okay, but in this professional role, here's how I calibrate to meet those expectations.
Yes.
So many things. It would be fun to keep talking classroom stories and examples, but to be mindful of your time, I'm going to ask you one more question. A lot of the podcast, and even where it started, was this idea of supporting early childhood teachers teaching in the COVID context and navigating this world that, I mean, we're what, 7 or 8 months in now, but still feels new. But thinking about sort of how some of this applies, you know, for science of parenting, you're typically talking to parents or family members. And so that means they're right there in the room with children interacting with them. When you think about the current state of classrooms during COVID, so either that we have a number of teachers right now that are teaching distance or virtual through a computer, or that children are moving back and forth between virtual and school And parents sometimes, you know, can provide them with that information a week ahead, but sometimes it's the night before. Mm-hmm. What are some temperament characteristics that we should keep in mind, or things that you would say, okay, teachers, if nine is too many and you can think about one or two temperament traits right now, specifically related to these COVID pieces, where would you point us?
Okay, so I have to confess that you did tell me you were going to ask this question. So I started to write down which traits were most important. And then I counted how many traits, and it was all nine. and I thought, how am I going to answer this question when she gets to this? And honestly, there isn't just one trait that is most important, because it's all about how much you got. Did you get a little or a lot? And for the teachers who are teaching virtually, their own temperament and the recognition that their own temperament is highly involved in how they're teaching, how they're maintaining their ability to teach throughout this is huge. Mm-hmm. And then to put that on to, you know, 15, 20, 25, 30 children, it's, I think, in all honesty, I would say they need to focus on themselves, because you first have to put on your own mask before you can help others. And the way teachers can help themselves help others is to recognize the reality of what their temperament is telling them right now. The reality, if they are not adaptable, is that they're struggling with this having to be flexible and immediately. If I can put my own mask on, air mask, give myself air, then I can help the children. And that's the answer I came up with.
No, I think that's a really good answer. And I hadn't really thought about that. But when you think about, so I just told you with our pre-service teachers, we'll say, sometimes you got to recalibrate to meet yes. the professional norms. And now you're living in a space without professional norms and examples and student teaching experience to draw on, and how your third grade teacher did it. And so you really are kind of paired back to your own instincts, and you would see your own temperament come out there. And so I actually think that's probably the best answer to say, gosh, if you are a person that really is really rhythmic and you're struggling that you've got these random meetings all over, then you really need to structure up your work time for yourself and say, I know I have this 9:30 Zoom with the kids, and then I have an hour to work. And here's what I'm always going to do. You know, I'm always going to refill my coffee and then work on these things, mm-hmm. not sort of wander around aimlessly or socially. It might not be aimlessly, 6 feet away socially. Or if you're a teacher that like is like, this is working for me, and don't understand why other people are struggling, you know, then being able to recognize that, or that you're a really sensitive teacher. And so the children who are struggling, it's really getting to you because you have your go-tos for the kids that come to school hungry or the kids that come to school, but you don't have your go-tos for the kids that cry because they just want to be with their friends. And so how do you start to process that? And so I actually think that's really great, is to say the best thing you could do is stop and think about your own temperament and how is that rubbing up against this? And what are the strengths in your temperament that are helping you to get exactly. through teaching in these ways.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for taking a whole season of temperament and putting it in a one episode for us. Is there anything else that you would say to teachers or other early childhood practitioners, home interventionists, or those, you know, childcare directors? Is there anything else that you would say is important to keep in mind?
So I would just say that by learning about temperament, even just a little bit, you have given yourself the opportunity to think about things a different way. And sometimes I would tell myself, I get the opportunity to redo. I get to start over. I get a do-over. I really needed a do-over with this particular kid, and now I get a chance to do that. And I just get a chance to see myself, give myself more grace, and recognize that now that I know this, I can change this.
That's such a great place to end too. You know, we often see the quote, and I can't think of who it's by. I'll look it up and edit. But once you know better, do better. And so sometimes it can be so paralyzing to you know, hear the something like this and then think, oh, that's what's going on with that child. But I think that idea of like, great, and now you know, and so you can, you know, you can try something new or one step better.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. Tell people how they can find you or how they can find Science of Parenting.
Yes. So the Science of Parenting is part of Iowa State Extension and Outreach. And Extension and Outreach is a place that we like to say allows Iowa State University to have a 99 county campus. So in every single county in Iowa, there is someone who can get a hold of or reach out or share information with you in terms of what I do. So there are about 12 of me across the state. And if you are looking for information on temperament or child development or, you know, parenting information, et cetera, you can find that at your county office, or you can go to www.scienceofparenting.org. We're also on Facebook and we are on Twitter. Each week we do drop a podcast. You can use your favorite podcast app to find us, Science and Parenting. And also we have an email that's pretty easy. It's just parenting@iastate.edu.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And we may have to get in touch with you in the future. Have you come back?
I would love it.
All right. Thanks, Lori.
Thanks to Lori Cordles, Family Life Specialist with Iowa State Extension and Outreach, for joining me today and talking about temperament and how we might consider temperament in the classroom. You can catch Lori and her colleagues on the Science of Parenting podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Teachers, we are cheering you on as you head into the end of the year. We're here for you. We want the best for you. We're wishing you a wonderful time with the kiddos in your class in the next couple of weeks, and then a well-deserved and restful break. Podcast recorded and edited by Christine Lippard. Music by Jason Lippard.